everyone. My name is Tom Regan, and I'm a licensed addiction counselor and a certified grief counselor for Heartview Foundation in Bismarck. Welcome to a program that we call Recovery Chronicles on KDAC. On this program, we celebrate recovery and talk about recovery. And thanks for listening. Very, very special guest today. He's a friend of mine. He is the director of counseling at Heartview. He is a licensed addiction counselor. And he has been working in the field for almost 35 years. His name is Bruce Carlson. Welcome to the program. I'm glad you said yes and that you're here on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah. I'm glad to be here today.
So you are a walking, talking wealth of information, you know, working in the field for almost 35 years. So there's so much I want to ask you. But I know that you're a person in long-term recovery, and you came to counseling that way, I'm sure, you know, like so many counselors.
Sure.
So tell us a little bit about your growing up years. Where are you from? I know you're from North Dakota, but cover your growing up years a little bit.
Sure, Tom. I was born in northeastern North Dakota, a little town called Fordville, North Dakota. And I grew up on a farm about 12 miles from there near a little town called Dahlin, North Dakota. There isn't a whole lot there anymore. Grew up on a family farm that my parents grew up on and worked on a farm all my life and went to school nearby and kind of went from there. I got into my addiction back when, during my teen years, like a lot of us farm kids, would go out on Friday and Saturday night and get a bootlegger and buy some beer and go out and party and drink. I remember the first time that ever happened. It became really, really important to me. I really liked the feeling I got from that. I suppose I was about 15, 16 years old at that time. Yeah. And it was about that time that I became totally obsessed with drinking and partying. And for the next how many years, that's what I did.
Yeah,
I drank whenever I could and later got into using other drugs, marijuana, pills, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever get you into trouble? And what kind of trouble?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I didn't have a lot of legal trouble. I had a DUI back in 1973. I didn't go to college right away after high school. I drank and partied my way through high school, so I wasn't a very good student. I got married shortly after high school, and I became an iron worker, a construction worker. So I was a union iron worker for about 13 years, and I worked all of the missile sites in eastern North Dakota, and later moved out here to Bismarck, and in 1977 worked on all of the power plants and that kind of thing.
So did you believe in the adage, work hard, play hard?
It was. Yeah, it was. I would drink almost every night and smoke pot almost every day and take speed to kind of keep me going. And, of course, it caused a lot of problems in my life. I had a lot of personal problems, married and divorced several times because of my drinking. And a lot of it made me really paranoid. I remember by the time I ended up coming into treatment at the Heartview Foundation in October of 1981, I had bill collectors knocking on my doors, and I was so paranoid. I couldn't go outside without wearing dark glasses. I didn't want to talk to people. There was no way that I could sit down and have a conversation like we're having right now. So it was really getting the best of me. That's what my life pretty much revolved around, was going to work, drinking, and using.
So how long have you been sober? How long have you been in recovery?
Well, I've been sober now since October 23rd of 1981. Yeah. So that puts us at
37.
Yeah. I got 38, my 38th sobriety birthday coming up. And when I first came into treatment, I sobered up when I was 29 years old. I turned 30 in treatment. I didn't come willingly. I came by the scruff of my neck because of...
How did you get into... what caused you to get into treatment?
Well, what happened is I was out drinking that night, and today it's still a total blackout, but I'd been out drinking and partying. I come home, and my wife at that time was upset with me, and I caused a ruckus, and I ended up in detox. And the next morning, I thought it would be like a lot of other times. She would come and get me out of detox, and I'd go back to work and lick my wounds and get over my hangover. But at that time, there was a man by the name of Chuck Lohman. And a lot of the old timers in the Bismarck Mandan area know of Chuck. Chuck was he was kind of like an icon.
Kind of a legend.
a legend in the addiction field here in the area. And he did an intervention on me at the time. He was working for the Burleigh County Sheriff's Department as a detox coordinator. And he gave me two choices. He said, Bruce, you can either agree to go to Hartview or I'm going to put you back and we'll get you to state hospital for 3 months. So it didn't take me very long to decide that I'll volunteer for Hartview for a month. And that's how I ended up there.
And that was as a volunteer, you said?
Well, that's the way he put it. That's the way he put it. So that was the hammer that was hanging over my head. But after I got into treatment, things settled down. I knew that I had a problem with alcohol. I knew that. But there was still a part of me that didn't think I was old enough yet and that I hadn't lost enough yet. I was only 29, turned 30 in treatment. I thought I had to be way older. But it was because of a lot of the people that were in treatment with me at the time that were on their way to recovery and getting into active stage of treatment that I decided, well, if this guy can do it, maybe I can do it too. And that's kind of what happened with me. I started feeling good about myself and started going to 12-step support group meetings and getting to know other people. And it's just kind of taken off from there.
So you're one of the fortunate, aren't you?
I mean, I am.
It stuck right away and it stayed. It didn't.
Yeah.
I mean,
whereas,
you've been a counselor for so many years, it doesn't always happen that way, does it?
It doesn't. It doesn't. And I think that first year it was strictly out of fear. I think I was so self-absorbed at that time and grandiose that I thought all the Bismarck PD probably had my name and address and all that stuff. And so I just stayed sober because I didn't want to end up back in treatment again. And going to meetings, you know, really, really helped. And that's kind of where things went from there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't soon after that I learned that if I want to keep living in a life of recovery and having good sobriety and serenity, I needed to change professions. So after 2 years of that, it came to the point that I was either going to have to take off and move out of state again to work as an iron worker, or I needed to do something different. So Chuck Lohman was also really instrumental and encouraged me to get into the addiction field. So that's where that started.
Yeah. And now you've been in the field for almost 35. Now you're a legend, just like. So let's follow your career for a little bit. You haven't always been at Hartview, have you?
No.
Yeah.
I trained at Hartview and at West Central Human Service Center back then. It was called the Missouri Valley Training Consortium. When I did all my academic out at Mary College back then, now it's the University of Mary, and those were the three training sites: UMary, Hartview Foundation, and West Central Human Service Center. So I did all my training there and finished my training in December of 1983, I think it was. And there wasn't a lot of jobs for addiction counselors back then. So I applied at a lot of different places. I applied in Fargo or Old St. John's Hospital. It isn't there anymore, but it's there. I applied for a job there, didn't get the job. Applied for one up in Minot, didn't get that job. And then I was offered a job out of North Dakota State Penn. And I had my second interview, and I the day they offered me the job, that there was one stipulation. I had to go back to Hartview and get a copy of my MMPI psych testing that I did, which they required to have a copy of. So I went over there to get a copy of that and sign a release. And the director of the adolescent unit at that time, Beth Stropingi, who was back here at Hartview again, came up to me and said, Bruce, we're going to have a job opening coming up here, and I'd like you to apply for it. So that's what happened. I applied for that job, and I got hired, and I went to work shortly after as a licensed addiction counselor. Well, it was a certified addiction counselor back then. That's before licensure took over. But I worked in the adolescent unit at Hartview for the next 8 years until things started transitioning and changing, and then I moved over and worked with adults and have been that since that time.
Right. So what do you think have been some of the secrets to your recovery or of your recovery? I know you've been at it a good long time now, but
sure.
But do you still have to? So, what are some of the secrets? And do you still have to you know, fine tune it, or do you still need tune-ups? You know, how do you stay there?
Well, I really believe in the basics, and that's what I learned, the basics of the 12 steps of making good choices, of a lot of those simple things, the cliches that we hear a lot of times in 12-step groups. Easy does it, one day at a time. Halt, don't let yourself get too hungry, angry, lonely, and tired are some real relapse triggers. And also surrounding yourself around positive people, people who empower me. I sometimes say I need to hang around people who are better than me. Not that anybody's any better or worse than anybody else, but can lift me up and make me a better person. That's what I've had to do. I've had to change everything that I've done in my life. I don't go to bars anymore. I don't avoid wedding dances or different kind of parties like that, but I make sure that I'm there for the right reason.
Yeah.
And I always make sure that I got a way out of there, that I'm not depending on somebody else for a ride. Plus, my wife is also really, really supportive of me, and my family's been always really supportive of me, so it's made it really easy that way.
Yeah.
And also, you know, being an addiction counselor and working at Heartview, I still tell patients that, you know, I went to Heartview in 1981 and I'm still in treatment.
Yeah.
You know, I come, I come back here every single day and, and even though I'm not facilitating groups so much anymore, I still really enjoy rubbing elbows with other people in recovery and listening to their stories and talking to them and just hanging out.
And as you know, I'm in I'm a person in long-term recovery as well, and working at Heartview, it keeps you in your program. I mean, you really have to live that program each and every day.
Sure.
And it keeps you on this on the right path, I think. I mean, you have to walk the talk.
And I really believe in honesty. The 12 steps, you know, alcohol is only mentioned one time in the 12 steps. You know, the 12 steps are steps to live our life by. I remember one of our chaplains we had a few years back, wasn't in recovery, but he had another chronic disease, and he used the 12 steps to live his life by. And I remember he used to say in one of his lectures and encourage people to use the 12 steps like road signs in life. And I've always told patients, I've grabbed onto that and say, a lot of us who know Bismarck Mandan, we can drive from one end of Bismarck to the other end of Mandan, you know, and adhere to every road sign and not really even think about it. You know, because that's branded into our heads, the stoplights, all these different kind of turn signals. And if we make those 12 steps like that in our life, we'll find out that it's helping us run our life in every area.
Sure.
I believe in being honest. I'd like to have things on the table and nothing hid. And if I bring a Heartview pen at home at night, I need to bring it back the next day because it's not mine. That's how I try to live my life. Of course, I'm not perfect and make mistakes, but the 12 steps also teach us how to go back and make amends and to say I'm sorry and to clean things up.
So in our profession, of course, you know, we see a lot of relapsing, and that's one of the frustrating parts about being a counselor. How do you deal with that every day, you know? What do you tell yourself? What do you tell the person who is relapsing?
It's really hard. I mean, it's disappointing. It's frustrating sometimes. And I think we've changed the way we've looked at it. Years ago, I can remember back in the days, you know, when the earlier years in my career, if somebody would relapse, sometimes we would just discharge them from treatment. They're not amenable for treatment, or they're not ready. They're not serious. Through the years, we've learned so much more about how to treat addiction that we look at it a whole lot different. And it isn't any different than any other chronic progressive disease. You know, and we've understood that for many, many years, that addiction is a disease. The American Medical Association first recognized that back in the early 1950s. I think it was 1953. And but a lot of times the public has had a hard time wrapping their mind around that. If only they'd have willpower, they could quit. And I think as addiction fields was frustrated with that too. But we have so many more tools. There's so many new medications that we can use. There's so many new treatment approaches and understanding, you know. And sometimes we compare it to, you know, like diabetes. I'm also a type 2 diabetic. And I have to you know, constantly be aware of my blood sugars, my A1C, what I'm eating, what I'm putting in my body. And sometimes I don't always make the best choices. And and that's a relapse. But the important thing is to realize, understand that, and to help our patients that we work with, support them, get them back up on their feet, dust them off, and get them moving again. Mm-hmm. And to be careful not to shame them, but to try to work with them.
Right.
Of course, they're all different. Some of the circumstances are different, but the dynamics is pretty much the same.
Mm. I want to remind people that you're listening to Recovery Chronicles, and our guest is Bruce Carlson, and he's a licensed addiction counselor. Well, for that matter, the director of counseling for Heartview Foundation, which goes back in our community to 1964. So, another thing I wanted to ask you, the phrase that you hear all the time is he or she needs to hit bottom, or they haven't hit their bottom yet. What does that mean? And do we still subscribe to that?
Oh, I hate that term.
Yeah. What does it mean?
Yeah, I hate that term. And they've talked about that for many, many years, that person, you know, that ad, he has to hit bottom or she has to hit bottom before they're ready. And, you know, I remember thinking about that and my old friend, Ron Gerhardt, who worked at Heartview for many, many years, dear friend who passed here several months ago. I remember he told me one time, you know, that bottom is when we quit digging a hole in life. Mm-hmm. You know, and and I've learned that there's always a deeper hole to dig, and and I remember one of our treatment videos, Father Martin, who's also an icon to me in the drug and alcohol field, said one time, if you think you've hit bottom, have another drink, you'll find out what bottom really is.
Okay,
and I've thought of that, and I've always kind of tried to instill that in people. I think bottom is when we end up dying from this disease.
Sure,
and that happens all the time. I go to several funerals every year of good people who have died and passed on way too young because of this disease. That's the common denominator many times.
Talk about the opioid crisis a little bit that is nationwide, and North Dakota is absolutely no exception.
Sure.
There really are more overdoses now than ever in this field. And how have you seen that change? And how... Doesn't that make being an addiction counselor even that much harder?
It is. You know, I can remember early on in the field, most of the patients that we would get at Heartview back in those days were alcohol, farmers, ranchers, businessmen. Mm. Everybody had a job. They had a family intact. They had insurance. They were, you know, they had a lot to lose. And those are the people that we would normally get into treatment. And very seldom would we see people that were addicted to pain medications or pills, or if they were, they'd bring them in, detox them, and there wasn't anything, you know, like methadone or Suboxone or anything like that to kind of help them get through the withdrawal and get them going in the right direction again. Mm-hmm. So it was helping them get through the withdrawal and all of that and then go from there. So that was the tools we had to work with. And it worked for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people with that had long-term, still do have long-term recovery that were addicted to painkillers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those painkillers started with legitimate pain, you know, a car accident or something, some legitimate pain.
An injury.
Of some kind. Back problems. Whatever. Yeah. And they got hooked on it.
Yeah.
So we're seeing so much of that now. And, you know, and of course now we're able to use Suboxone. We're able to use methadone. We've opened our methadone clinic, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever it was. And we're able to see people do pretty well. Every morning when I come to work, I always come to work about 45 minutes early and get things ready. But I always like to walk over to our methadone clinic and walk in the morning when they're dosing and hang out with a lot of the patients coming in there. And I just really, really enjoy it. One thing, every one of them have accepted the first step. They all know that they're addicted and have a problem. And and a lot of them have got really good attitudes. They're fun to visit with. And there's a lot of them doing really, really well and going in the right direction. They're getting jobs. They're paying their child support. They're being moms and dads. And they're being responsible citizens again. And of course, a lot of times, you know, on the street and in the news, we hear about the tragedy. The ones that don't make it or the ones that are getting in trouble and that kind of things are the ones. But there's a lot of them out there that are doing really, really well. They're not the ones we hear about anymore because they're back being a productive part of society, just like other patients who struggle with other addictions.
Right.
Get clean and sober and move on in life, you know.
And meth has never really gone away, has it?
Meth has never gone away. And, you know, and over the years, these things kind of go in trends. It just kind of depends on. I heard somebody say here a while back after the Civil War, you know, there was a real increase again on opiates.
Sure.
You know, with the amputees and all of that. And then the 60s come along with the diet pills, the amphetamines, the Zip, the White Cross, the Black Beauties, all of that kind of things that people were taking.
The Valley of the Dolls.
All of that, you know. And then I can remember when it was crack cocaine, and you know. But one of the ones that have never ever left the scene is alcohol, still number one. Yep. Marijuana, still number two or so. Those are just a steady constant all the time. And we have to remember that those are dangerous drugs too.
And North Dakota. Leads the nation as either number one or two in binge drinking, and statistically and in underage drinking. So we're dealing with the consequences of all of that.
And we can't forget nicotine. You know, nicotine is a tough thing to quit. I too was a heavy smoker at one time. I was a 2-pack-a-day smoker.
Came with the territory.
I ended up in 1984. I ran out of cigarettes one night, and I thought, well, let's see if I can make it through the night without one. And then it was, let's see if I can get through the next day. And then pretty soon I started feeling so much better, and I slept so much better that I was able to quit smoking cigarettes. Then I got into running marathons, and that became an addiction, so forth.
Well, you as a person, you seem to have a lot of willpower. As I observe you as a person, I mean, not everybody could quit nicotine that way, or even quit alcohol the way you quit. So how necessary is willpower in when it comes to entering recovery?
Well, I don't know if I have good willpower or not. I think our addiction, you know, I really believe that if we don't get a real good balance in our life, you know, our addiction shows its way so many other ways. You know, alcohol and drugs, I've been able to manage that, but it's still there. I know that if I started going to the bar and hanging out and drinking a Diet Coke, I might be able to do that for a couple of times. Pretty soon I'll be in a place where it'll be really easy to take a drink and I'll be off and running. I don't know that from experience, but I know that from listening to so many other people that have tried to do that. Same with smoking. You know, but also as a diabetic, it's also, I'm a foodie, you know, I love food you know, and I've had to really work hard and keeping my weight down. I've tried to eat healthy and make good choices. But sometimes if I'm stressed out at night or I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, it's really easy to have a bowl of cereal or some ice cream or sneak a candy bar at the counter and I'm off and running again.
How about the importance of spirituality in recovery?
That's a big part. In the big book of AA, it describes addiction as threefold. We're physically drunk, we're mentally drunk, and we're spiritually drunk. And if we just put the cork in the bottle or stop the alcohol and drug use, we're 1/3 sober. That means we're still 2/3 drunk or high. And that's what a dry drunk is. When you hear the word dry drunk, it's that a person isn't actually drinking or using, but their behavior and attitude is as such. So I really believe that when we get into a program like a 12-step program or a good treatment program and start working good recovery, we start dealing with the emotion and the mental part. That's the second part. But the spiritual part comes too, and that's what the 12 steps teach us. I can't do this by myself. I need your help. I need the help of other people, a sponsor, other good people in my life to help pull me along. And I believe that's what the spiritual part is. You know, step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can resource a sanity. That power can be a lot of things, you know, and it could be my 12-step support group. and in learning to turn it over and making that an important part. Mm-hmm. But the spiritual part is a real important part. Learning to pray. Sure. God, help me stay sober today. God, thank you for helping me stay sober. And getting out of ourselves and praying for others and helping others is a big part of that.
Having gratitude, yeah. You know.
Gratitude and humility.
Yeah. Our guest today on Recovery Chronicles is Bruce Carlson. He's the director of counseling at Heartview. And he's been in the field for almost 35 years, so this has been an education today. I told you, Bruce, it would go fast, and we only have about 3 minutes left. So for the listener today, someone listening to this program today, or a mom and dad maybe who are listening, and they know that their son or daughter are in trouble, what's your best advice? What do you say to them? I mean, we know there's so many out there. They know they have a problem. They know they have to stop. Quit. What do you say to them? What do they need to do?
Well, I think one of the big things is finding help, getting help. And there's a lot of roads to recovery. It isn't, you know, of course, I've been at Heartview for many years, but there's a lot of good treatment programs in North Dakota and finding them. I tell family members and parents, quit walking on eggshells around them, because us addicts do a really good job of keeping family members at bay and making them walk on eggshells. Start breaking eggshells. You know, sit down and talk to them. Be straight up with them in a good way. Talk from your heart, but try to get them some help. Reach out. You know, we at Heartview have the Heart Program, which is called Helping Everyone Achieve Recovery Today, which is free to the public.
Every Monday night. Yeah.
Monday night from 6 to 8. And it's really taken off and been great. Al-Anon is a great program.
Mm-hmm.
There's programs in the schools. There's school counselors. I mean, make it known. Ask around. Mm-hmm. You know. And check it out.
Yeah. Talk to your minister.
Clergymen. Yeah. Pastors. Counselors.
Talk to your doctor.
I get calls every single day from family members, people having a loved one. What should I do? How can we get this person in treatment? So I do a lot of coaching people on how to do an intervention and get things lined up to make this happen.
Sure. We should do another program sometime with you as the guest, and we could talk about interventions and doing an intervention and the effects of of addiction on the family. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of parts to that.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll have to have you back. So. We'll have to. And we got about a half a minute left. So I want to thank you for coming on. Bruce is my boss and a mentor and a friend. Bruce Carlson is director of counseling for Heartview. Bruce, we close the program with the Serenity Prayer every time. So
Great. Let's
do that.
All
God,
right.
Grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change.
The courage
to change the things I can.
And the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks again.
I sing the song because I love the man. I know that some of you don't understand. Milk blood to keep from running out. I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a setting sun.